meeting Labor Commerce come to order.
Present Senator Mulcahy, Senator Lodi, and Senator Elias.
The bill before this is House Bill 4.
Introduced by Senator Martin. Care to testify, Terry?
Thanks, Senator. Appreciate your lovely response to have the hearing on this bill. I'd like to take a few moments to give you a little overview of how we got into this situation. Probably about midterm last year, suddenly became
aware of from the Alaska Journal contractor that there were certain changes
in the normal administrative procedures and awarding contracts, basically that had to do with donor provision for insurance coverage. They were alarmed at it, and being the chairperson for Health, Labor, and Commerce, we became alarmed about it and asked questions. And I would have Mr. Bailey later to give you a lot of documents and the backup information that we had received. We did send information and the letters to Mr. Chuck Conway, at that time chairman of ABA, and asked questions. And because we didn't get satisfactory answers, then we proceeded to have hearings and do evaluation of the problem that was addressed. In short, it seemed like that one or two individuals decided that the state should go into wrap-up insurance for hydroelectric projects. Questions, Mr. Chairman. So many documents here just recently, especially the one from the legal counsel that was hired through the speaker, and it gives a good overall review. It does show that APA and other agencies have corrected some weaknesses in what was done under this wrap-up program, and it does establish potential guidelines that they need to review before they get into another wrap-up.
Representative Martin, as I read the bill in its present form, it doesn't give any option for the state to pursue a wraparound if, in fact, it's the economically thing to do. So that it precludes that option. You said it out there where it doesn't set up a mechanism for it to do it or not to do it. If in fact, it's here is the best route to go.
Yes, sir. That is a kind of a personal decision. His experience and then talking with many experts throughout. Once this became public, I got a number of phone calls from agencies and individuals that were put on the report saying this wrap-up program was successful, this one was successful, this one was successful. Those individuals somewhere along got the my number and talked to me. They don't use us as a rationale to wrap up the short because it did not work. The fire from San Francisco line did not work. The tunnel line, the gentleman called me from Alyeska. He said, well, they said only a couple of questions for 20 years, some of these long cases or injury cases of someone, but they didn't feel the best to use them as an example of how that public work. In this case here, part of the decision was made also with the report from the budget audit, and that we should go into the ongoing evaluation project by project before the state undertakes it. At that point, then maybe change the law, but right now, from a layman's point of view, the legislature, I don't think it's going to be within the best interest of the state of Alaska.
But just to pursue the same thing that
proceeding on the platable form first go around, I would think that we'd maybe want to take the time to address it and look at both sides of the issue and say, well, maybe in these circumstances that, put some guidelines in there rather than just throwing it on the table.
Mr. Chairman, for me, that's a good logical thing to go by, so I tell them what to lead to. And maybe the Tai Lake, since that one is received, continuing that is what I've been contacted for, give us some good indication of what to expect going on. So Tai Lake is online, it's still being covered by the original carriers, and maybe in a year or 2 years, 3 years down the line. But to make decisions. Safety valve that doesn't allow the state to be vulnerable for organic liability.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One brief question. Notwithstanding your bill, wouldn't it still be possible in the statutes for various group insurance mechanisms to be utilized that are present in the statutes?
There could be if you do it in a legal way. In this particular case, it's quite obvious that. Is one of the facetious groups we use, different numbers we use, even workers' compensation group had to get into the act and prohibit the individuals from using the work number that they use. I think it was the University of Alaska's workers' comp number that they use. Certainly not very. So things were done so fast that it just took a lot of investigative work. And as far as real detail, I'd have to issue it. Talk to Mr. Barry.
Yes, and specifically addressing, if you'll notice, the attorney's letter from the law firm and signed by the former Attorney General, G.K. Edwards. Even under wrap-up proposed, not only what was done for the legal questions, there still are serious legal implications in restraint of trade, illegal tying agreements. Under workers' compensation statutes, there's the question of a self-insured sub as a condition of doing business, of canceling by a state agency of a bona fide self-insured certificate issued by the Workers' Compensation Board. So there are still some serious legal questions about a wrap-up at all, as well as just in the particular case that brought it to the attention of the committee originally on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I guess the question I have is, are we really concerned with whether or not there's a cost factor involved or whether or not the method they used to make these contracts was legal?
Well, so Mr. Chairman, there was a number of questions involved. Number one, very few people knew about it before they were told to take out your insurance coverage on their particular name project. And then that's when they were all loaded on particular insurance aspects out of it to decrease costs, obviously. But then when they found out the individual contractor, this is questionable too, was he able to buy his own insurance to cover the project, and evidently according to some people that this person's expert.
affected by new joint ventures, specifically Swan Lake, Great Lake, and Solomon Gulch. The low bidder had an experience modification of 1.22. Means its rates are being surcharged 22% for adverse loss experience. Another slightly misleading statement is that there is no safety incentive because the experience modification is not effective if there's a wrap-up insurance program in effect. The fact is that it is still effective. IDA, again, is a good example. The payroll and accident statistics are being reported to the National Council on Compensation Insurance. This is in accordance with the requirements of the National Council for the Federal Division of Insurance. In other words, a poor safety record on the job site will indeed affect your experience future, your future experience modifications. I'd like to give you just a few numbers on TIA. And obviously, TIA is not completed, so we don't know exactly where we're going to come out. So, I'll give you some projections. The first thing we did was
suggest simply that you allow the option to exist under certain specified conditions. And that with allowing that option, there are a lot of considerations as to how much can be saved, whether it's 2%, let's say, of the project cost, or 1%, or whatever. There are many different numbers that can be used for many different reasons. But when you're talking about the revenue potential that the state is looking at, and a project the size of Susitna, and the potential costs involved, the ability to perhaps use such a technique to save, whether it's $20 million or $50 million or whatever, is useful. So we say, don't simply ban the process, allow us the option. What we recommend is that in allowing the option, and the letter of intent expresses this a bit clear, is number one, that we be forced to write a finding, a specific written finding, that lays out the cost-effective benefits of where RAPA intended to be used, that in effect we, as an operation of law, be required to show it's cost-effective to do this, not an after-the-fact situation, but that it's cost-effective to do this. Number two, that that finding be concurred in by the agency-headed board. And number three, this is where we, it says, also needs to be concurred in by the director of the Office of Management and Budget. Now, originally, there were times one could speculate, we were trying to find a neutral party who was outside of a commissioner who might be on a board, such as like the Power Authority. You can't have a commissioner of a department overriding a specific board. So we suggested that a finding be written, specifically lay out the facts for all public purview. Number two, that that finding would have to be concurred in by the agency and also by a neutral party. Item number, which will be the one that we present to the committee, another part is that we may not use the state of Alaska's self-insurance program to provide insurance under this section. We specifically recognize that there could be great liability to the state of Alaska in using self-insurance. There may or there may not be, but we can settle that question. In a later section of the bill, we've made sure that the present construction of House Bill 4 doesn't also include, as presently written, it doesn't address a legal problem that exists in the fact that an instrumentality of the state does not include municipal corporations, political subdivisions, service districts, or school districts. Tries to clarify the fact that even when you're talking of instrumentality of the state, that's not what you're talking about. Otherwise, you're literally trying to ban RAPA on the behalf of everybody who might ever want to use it anywhere in the state of Alaska. So, there have been many questions that have been raised on the effects that have happened in the Taiti Hydroelectric Project. There are things that could have probably have been done better, probably maybe should have been done differently. Those questions can go on forever. But to simply ban an option means that with $5 billion of the public's money, if that's what we're talking about, for example, of the Susitna project, you walk to the table with one hand tied behind your back. Now, in proof, as a letter of intent states, that the state should not, and this will be part of the history record that also is expressed in terms of the tapes of the committee hearing here. The intent is not to interfere with private business prerogatives and the contractor's prerogatives of providing the best deal. We've got to prove that we have a better deal. And that if the contractor, on large projects, the contractors themselves would probably provide just as well, equal, or better wrap-up type insurance, because that's what a large contractor does, exactly that.
They, on very large projects. So, It's a process.
You should consider it on $50 million projects. We're trying to keep this in a realm of reasonableness and say there's a boundary here where there's several million dollars involved, and you want to make sure that you've considered all the information.
There are probably a whole lot of different issues. Those who would suggest that perhaps we should just ban it if we knew go back and get it.
It's much more difficult to reinstitute something than to force us to, us being the state, to prove to you, when there's no mitigating reason otherwise, to prove that there's a positive benefit from it.
There have been questions raised in the past about the public contracting laws and the fact that there is an imposition of an insurance company on a particular person. You could very easily provide a bid on a project, for instance, just as an example, where you say, provide us two bids, one with insurance and one without. I mean, those kinds of potentialities may exist. But again, why simply ban the process, which is exactly what this bill does? It simply brings the process to a halt. The question is not addressed.
We would simply recommend that also on a report done by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee issued January 11th, 1983, does not suggest the cancellation of the backup on the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee issued January 11th, 1983, does not suggest the cancellation of the wrap-up on the Taiyi Hydroelectric Project. Because of the potential additional costs involved, approximately in excess of $1 million. So we would simply say that we wish the committee to consider an amendment to the bill, consider such amendments, and secondly, consider the letters of a letter of intent to go along with it, to express the legislature's desire, so it be, as to where you intend to maybe have it used or not have it used, or even addressed at all. But to avoid the process, we believe that government should not take the approach to leave people in the dark and say we're going to come and do this and we're going to come and do that. As an operation of law, you will require us to write a cost-benefit finding if we intend to use it. We believe that that's probably one of the best control purposes and best control methods there is.
Would you enlighten us again what the report, Budget and Audit report said about the Taiyi?
The Budget and Audit Committee report, which I have in front of me here,
it says,
let me, if I could just quote from the end of it, probably be the best.
As noted above,
some of the factors used in this estimate are very subjective, and the actual cost of canceling the current wrap-up program in place for Taiyi Lake could vary considerably from the quoted $2.25 million. There does appear to be a general agreement, however, that cancellation would result in increased costs and would therefore not be in the best economic interests of the state. We concur with this assessment.
What type of a cost-efficient did they look at that cost-efficient factor before they awarded that risk?
This was just, if they did, that they didn't they?
No, Mr. Chairman. All they did was just, there were questions apparently raised at one point in time as a special request to the Budget and Audit Committee that said, we've got a problem here, should we undo it? That's the only question they're addressing. But exempting this report, saying this one never existed, that's exactly what we suggest. As an amendment to this bill, rather than ban the process, force us to write this long beforehand with objective facts and prove to you.
If we can't prove to you, and with all the parties.
parties who have to sign on the dotted line to say we agree with this assessment and all the facts. If we can't prove to you that it's done cheaper, better, and in the interest of the state, then we shouldn't be doing it.
As I understand risk management, this particular time cannot tell us whether or not it is cost efficient. So if they can't tell us that at this point, they mean, how can they tell us that before they start?
Mr. Chairman, the response, perhaps the only really effective response I can make to that is simply say that they didn't do it beforehand. The Tai-E project isn't done. There are many examples, written support that has been presented to us that do show that there may be some benefit from it. The article on the St. James Bay project that was presented to you, it's there. There are potential benefits there. And so, I guess when it comes to the Tai-E project, and I hate to make this sound like just a simple expression, to say that a bad fact situation, which may have existed on Tai-E Lake, should not destroy a good public policy worth preserving, or one that anyone would use, when you have the potential of a large project, a very large construction project.
It's a good public policy to enter into an agreement like the Tai-E. It may not be in a particular manner. It may not be good policy to do that, and that's why, exactly why
we are proposing the alternative we're proposing. We should be forced to tell you, to prove to you beforehand and before it starts that it's good policy to do that. If we can't prove that, then we shouldn't be doing it.
Just another question. Do we have this the same risk of that we do in making this large savings also costing us that much more? It's a risk equal both ways.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that.
Without some type of a cost analysis before we get into
right.
it.
I don't know that, and I agree with some cost analysis beforehand. And that's exactly what we are proposing, that we do this beforehand, and that before we use it, we have to do it beforehand. If you provide the amendment.
If the bill passes in the simple form that it exists, there is no potential to even address the question other than reintroducing legislation. And that tends to bury the problem or to bury the issue rather than allowing a mechanism for it to be used potentially in the future.
Aspen, isn't it important to distinguish in this case the question of pure insurance law as opposed to the practices of the Alaska Power Authority, which have been questioned?
Mr. Chairman, without question, that's part of it.
In terms of pure potential pure insurance law versus what they may or may not have done, and done have not done correctly, there are a lot of things, just in general, that probably would have been done differently, given hindsight. I don't know. Insurance costs that sometimes can be up to 8% of the cost of a project. If you have a $100 million project, that's $8 million at the max going out, even if it's 10%. A project can overrun for many, many, many reasons. The other 90% can cause as much problem, or 92%, as that 8%. So the practices of the, let's say, the power authority in this particular case, and we're not making an assessment on whether what they did was right, wrong, or different. What we're saying is there are probably a lot of different things that would have been done. But to prevent that from happening again, obviously this particular issue has such great interest that it resulted in the introduction of this bill. But we don't believe that, I think, is that curing the problem simply by cutting it out altogether and tying one's hands on 8% of the total project cost with the types of projects that we're facing and the types of revenue estimates that we're facing and the types of need to ration funds to the best degree that this provides.
reject an alternative. And I can only say one thing from having, when a, quote, bureaucrat has to write something down, they do tend to document it very, very carefully when your signature goes on it. And there is nothing better to assure that you'll do it correctly than that.
Questions?
Yes, did I understand you to say it in your testimony that you considered the director of the Office of Budget Management and moved to a third party?
Well, I would say that.
You've never been called to that.
From your perspective, or from both. I think from our perspective is that, number one, if it came to the power of third, we couldn't have the Commissioner of Commerce, for instance, there, because that would be a direct conflict with being on the power authority. You run into specific legal problems automatically. So, but what we did want to have was a sensitivity to administrative direction. Exempting that, you can pick a commissioner or a cabinet officer outside of the Department of Commerce, let's say, but there are multiple sequences of events that could happen in the Department of Education, or the Department of Administration itself. And interestingly enough, it could have been the Department of Administration, but risk management is there, and that would probably draw a lot of fire anyway. So,
but was there any?
We decided there is one party who would be sensitized to the needs of the situation, would also have an organization and resource to draw on to see whether or not the cost and benefit conclusions make sense.
Was there any thought you had of going outside of government? Excuse me? Was there any thought of going outside of government?
Chairman,
I don't know.
Okay, no. There wasn't really. We were just trying to find the most effective method that we could find to assure that that protection was in place.
Well, let me assure you that I don't always consider it neutral.
I won't add it.
Did you review in detail program, how it came about, who was actually involved in it?
Mr. Chairman, in terms of the Tai Lake project, I have not reviewed that in as much detail as you would say, looking through all the documents. I have looked through, and I requested, before this amendment was even suggested, perhaps this sounds terribly bureaucratic, but before we even suggested this approach, we requested written support from people outside of the administration to see if there even was any potential, even a dollar, of cost savings available somewhere. Would someone even support that idea before we even went any further? Because if there's no potential for cost savings whatsoever, and that is a proven fact, then there's really no reason to do it. I mean, other than the fact that there may be other reasons to do it, but let's say from cost-benefit approach, which would be a mitigating factor. But we received information. Some of it was mixed, some of it was positive, some of it was not so positive. Some said it'll take some time to find out. But in reviewing all that information, you do come up with one conclusion. Simply banning it does not address the issue. And simply saying you must do it doesn't address it either, because it doesn't provide for a rational analysis. But forcing the people who might do it to prove it would probably get an awful lot of information on the table that hasn't been there before, and would address a lot of the questions that happen on the hydroelectric project.
In effect, who made the final decision that this is the program they're going to adopt?
That this is the approach.
This is the approach.
This was done by as a consensus opinion of the Legislative Budget Review Committee in the Office of the Governor. All the members in attendance.
Well, who sold it? Who sold the program?
Sold it? I would say that there were several groups that provided information. In terms of this particular approach, I would have to admit that I sold it. In terms of providing information to say, this is how one might construct it. There was a very long time and consideration, and there were a lot of questions asked. self-insurance that we have that goes beyond workers' comp that we've allowed to be used. This involves the Department of Commerce, very mitigating interest. Sign off on it. We don't input the information to it. We can provide information. Someone else has the right to finding the affected agency has the right to finding the affected agency, commissioner or board has to write, has to agree to it. And someone other than the Department of Administration, i.e. in this case, Office of Management Budget, has to agree to it, but not us.
The neutral office.
Right.
Representative Martin indicated that in his review of what had happened, the wrap-up insurance that he filed, that there were, I don't know how many cases of probably violation of administrative procedures, plus probably violation of state law. Did you find that in your research at the program? The way it was handled?
In terms of our own research, that is still going on because there are many shades of what is considered to be a violation. There are probably lots of things that would have been done differently to, let's say, there are a lot of things, for instance, that aren't a violation of law, but maybe a violation of good judgment, good practice.
You're talking big money.
Yes.
So those technicalities.
But
the result in a lot of dollars.
Yes, Chairman, no question about that. And that's, again, why we propose that before something gets off the ground, we do this first. Because even after reviewing what has transpired, we believe that these questions should be addressed beforehand and not after the fact. Even if it's not a violation of law, but a simple violation of good judgment, perhaps. You know, not taking a position one way or the other. Recognize it, but saying that even with that, even if you have that concern, that the concern here is merely one of allowing an option. If you ban it, you go to the table with one hand tied behind your back.
Maybe we should have had this 3 years ago.
Thanks. I do have extra copies for the committee. I'd like them, please.
Safety
Right, to the individual on the job.
Right. That's, I've heard it implied, but I wondered if you'd give me examples of how you feel it would be so, because it would be an important issue.
Well, the cost of insurance is based on the track record. If they all of a sudden get sloppy, they know this to be a high cost item. So they emphasize safe programs from a cost and the safety viewpoint.
Well, maybe I understood that the person that evidently was the insurance agent said that if they go into a joint venture, it's nobody has a record, they go to the highest cost anyway. So option
in private insurance, right?
Well, in this tool, regardless of whether it's risk management or not, it's an incorporation, if it's a joint venture on one of these. So they have to go out and get them a rate, and they start at the bottom of the totem pole and work up. So then I also understood that if his able company did have a good rate, and I asked them to provide this information to us down the trail, right, that then that rate would be taken into consideration for the contractor. These two things are true. Does that take care of your concern?
No, not definitely not. I don't think there's any track record of Harrison Western. I think a flat rate, wrap up rate, and they can be irresponsible to stay at the same rate. You understand?
And far as unfair competition, it wouldn't take care of the problem.
Modifications
the way that you receive a good experience modification, and this is what the 675 members of the AGC were saying,
was
you get it by, number one, having a bona fide safety program. You have safety engineers on your payroll. Number two, you have a year-round maintenance program. And number three, you have new equipment, which implies financing carrying charges. These are all overhead charges. In return, you may become a self-insured and bid, such as Peter Kiewit and Sons did on Terror Lake, and receive the project at about a 0.37 experience modification. If that's wiped out, you still have the same safety people on your payroll. You still have the same maintenance program. You still have the same finance charges for your new equipment, your same capital outlays. On the other hand, companies from outside of Alaska who have no safety people and no safety record, have no maintenance program whatsoever, and have no equipment at all, they will rent junk
or run anything else, they have a real incentive to be able to bid on this. That's workers' compensation. That's a start. Second, what are the other two forms of insurance being provided? Builder's risk and general liability. Who is the beneficiary of that? For errors, sins, and omissions that the contractor commits against the state in the performance of the job. Case in point, Tidy Lake, April of last year. A new module, which was part of that permanent housing, the contractor dropped offloading. Project manager, Alaska Power Authority, said, that's not acceptable. Calls for a new module to be put in place as part of the permanent housing. Insurance adjuster, state of Alaska, representing contractor, who broke it, comes out and says, well, just fix that corner and go ahead and put it in place. Project manager, APA, says, no, you got 2 weeks and I'll execute against you. Contractor, broke it in the first place, has a performance bond in place to get it in place, says, whenever you guys in the state make up your mind, let me know. What incentives are there to run not only a safe job, but a secure job? Protect from theft, protect from other things, because the policy is being purchased and provided for by the state of Alaska. Within the findings of a budget audit, contractual procedures, APA brokerage contracts. To date, all APA insurance reviews or brokerage service have been performed by commercial in Dawson.
With payments to the brokers and presented in Appendix A, this has generated considerable controversy. Specifically, that controversy and the findings that came out of it are that this particular wrap-up, which is supposed to be saving us money, is workers' contracts. Tidy contractors and their employees is provided under a policy by an approved insurer, but is, in the end, self-insured by the state. Exactly what they're saying. The state, on April 29th, 1982, a request was made of the workers' compensation to the workers' compensation division to Commissioner Orbeck to revoke the state self-insured certificate for these particular abuses. That hearing was granted at a pre-hearing meeting chaired by Chairman Cook. The state agreed that they would not be self-insured from that point in time. That they are not running a wrap-up, they are running a self-insured retention. And until there is an accounting of those monies, no one will know for sure. It would appear that the coverage to show these savings are to put on the state's master policies as a named insurer, the power authority, and the individual contractors, so that the policy that covers this building, the workers' comp that covers the staff and the individuals here, is covering those private contractors for their benefit. That is your wrap-up. That is why every sector of Alaska has been opposed to it and so testified before the House. As far as the particular areas requested at some point in time, and I apologize for the lateness in getting it over, I thought the committee had it, is the legal questions as raised by Sheehan Edwards
those questions were raised for the purpose of, say, that some of the problems, not only on the Tahiti Lake Road, but any wrap-up would have come to this proposed item. There should be a third avenue, three, let's keep it. And that is an illegal tying agreement if the state has no public purpose or interest in seeing who is providing the insurance, but only rather than the insurance be in place. The question immediately that would come to mind, then someone who is denied that insurance premium may under 42 U.S.C. 19 be in place. The question immediately that would come to mind, then someone who is denied that insurance premium may under 42 U.S.C. 1983 choose to bring suit against the state for engaging under the color of authority in antitrust under another individual to restrain trade. As the contractors and the insurance companies also pointed out in the wrap-up, under general liability, under builder's risk, and under other areas, that it's extremely disruptive of the private sector in Alaska. They have an agent that they have done business with for years, a company, be forced to stop doing business with them in order to work on a state project is extremely disruptive. There are many questions that are raised that if it is allowed, as to at what point in time does the state become the insurance agent and the contractor, i.e. the state become the insurance agent and the contractor.
I were to work for contractor X, Y, Z.
On job in Kodiak and went to Tahiti Lake to start there. Injured en route. Which insurance policy could correct with normal X, Y, Z company as a self-insured or the state's Tahiti Lake? At what point in time?
The 3.6 million figure that we knew about that had been paid up at this point in time were committed to. Because there are provisions to keep raising. If there's any more questions, sir, I'd be able to ask them.
Good question. Mr.
Chairman.
So, I was wondering, Barry, so it's hard to do. I mentally it's quite difficult to determine the cost of fishing.
Yes, sir.
I mean, could they actually predict the tie is going to be cheaper?
By the wrap-up versus their method?
No, sir, not really. In this regard, because some of the costs of insurance obviously are hidden, but number one is that if they are and have a legitimate and bona fide workers' comp policy, then they must charge a premium. Those are set by NCCI. I think you will hear testimony in a few minutes that the rates that they are paying through their carrier that they have selected are double what an individual company was paying that was forced into taking their policy. And secondly, as a matter of policy concern, and I want to pre-testify, is the fact that there's every indication that a certain number of Alaskans may have suffered a loss of their retirements because of a break in service artificially caused by being forced to go to another program. And that's another policy question. Is it the policy of the state to punish Alaskan workers and to force them into breaks of service? I mean, it may seem absurd, but if in fact that occurred, I think it's very serious that as a cost of doing business here, part of the logging portions that they had to change to a different fee roll by changing it being placed under an insurance, it caused a break in service in their annuity. There was a cliff vesting that wiped out their retirements. I think it's pretty serious because it was not that. And the insurance that was being provided was ostensibly for the benefit of the worker and the employer, their builder's risk and general liability, workers' comp. So what was the state doing forcing them to incur that break in service? So what are the true costs? That's the bottom line of the question.
You really brought up a good point before,
and that's the risk. Any charges that will exceed their, they've set up a $300,000 self-insured retention fund, which is a large deductible, and then reinsured it. If there is a big disaster that is caused and the contractor is responsible for, and the reinsurance kicks in and it goes against the state's master policy, that's under the general liability portion. So there are some real questions that it does raise on those points. Where do you ever show that it really is cost effective? It's a nice theory, but it still is not to demonstrate. These figures that are cited in Canada, the situations are a little different. I remember reading articles the last few years about Senator Edward Lawson from the British Columbia Senate, saying that he's very disappointed because of the massive cost overruns in St. James and other Northeast developments and the cost of the development of British Columbia. So again, in each of those instances, say we saved $22 million. Say 55 million, 1.2 billion overrun. Where's the savings? That's the question. We can't blame the insurance. Well, then, aren't you saving the savings? The testimony last year on BART for the people who were involved was that BART did save money within their accounting figures. The only problem was is that, like we pointed out here, they were paying double what everybody else in the community was paying because they didn't.
It's a savings in the eyes of the builder.
Yes, sir.
No questions, Mr. Chairman.
I think this is the committee did it right here.
May of 82. They are interested in our workers' compensation. organization, so that in turn excluded them from participating in our company. The smaller project in Petersburg, a little subcontractor, Spring Valley, had a contract with do some work, Tai. They hired another company called The Mill, which they were in our company, participating in our program, workers' comp, pension, and health insurance. They did their contract, did their work, to come to find out that they are not insured through us because they have to go right to the state. So we lost those people, and those people that thought they had pensions being paid into health and welfare did not. Sealy Inc. is another big contractor. He's been in our exchange since 1976, and he obtained a subcontract with Tai to do the right-of-way logging for this Tai project. He signed the contract, and with needed a proof of insurance, he elected to retain our coverage for the insurance under the workers' compensation program. He paid us the premiums, we paid his claims, and after that, he was come to find out he's under contract with us, part of the reservist management, and now all the premiums that he paid us, we owe him back. That we still plan on paying his claims because we're liable for him, and that's part of the service we do under a contract. We kind of interested in wanting to know how the wrap-up program or the rates are established for some reason. The logging rate during the TIE program under the National Council, which is Class Code 2702, logging at that time was $39.22 per hundred of payroll. And that was from Mr. Donald Coach, the Chief of Marketing Surveillance State of Alaska, give us those figures. The Alaska Loggers Association, we've been affiliated with timber industry for 25 years, and our experience in that class code of logging, we have established an accepted rate in 1982, $20.30 per hundred of payroll. Then we also take into consideration experience modification. Now, experience modification works in essence the safety experience. Okay, through good safety, you have reduced rates because you have reduced claims. Okay? And all of those are combined to getting the rates down. So, if you have a safety incentive program, employee selection, indoctrination, and so forth, then you're going to have better claims record, which the claims part spends the money. And right now, we have one of the highest risks there is, other than I think building demolition is the highest rate of the logging almost in state class. We've even reduced our $20.30 down to this year to $18.10, which apparently the wrap-up program does not take into consideration or cannot deviate from National Council. It's required by law. If you kick in a program with, let's say, Sealy Inc., let's say they were awarded, they deviate just from our $18.10 current rate. They have an experience mod of 0.73. So they're saving 30% even of that, which it's quite a bit of savings when the person is bidding. That is taken into consideration. More savings they can produce through their insurance practices and coverage, the lesser rate they're going to be bidding on a contract, and then you probably be the lower bid if they're using 8%. And we are have read House Bill 4, and we are in support of House Bill 4 as it was passed by the House.
Thank you, George. If you would get the copy of that, the amendments proposed by the administration.
I have a copy of those.
Have you had a chance to review it?
Yes, I have.
What's your
the area that the executive head or board of the contracting agency, it's more or less going, the same thing is going to happen, which is occurring now, that an agency will be allowed to put together a wrap-up program, which is more or less a self-insured program without any incentives or reductions or experience mods. And consulting service. Maybe they currently have brokers now. I would say they pay a pretty good size chunk of that savings to them to make sure they're getting the proper insurance. And that's, I think it's Crude and Black, Dawson and Marsh McLennan, which they now call herself APCOD, which is a joint venture because Crude and Black is established here in Alaska and Marsh McLennan is. And for instance, doing bids with other companies, we don't. There's nothing that says it's required to have a broker. A broker is a firm that just places at the cheapest rate the insurance. It's also, they're going to go out and get estimates from outside companies. And if it's an outside company that's coming into Alaska, they can't deviate from the National Council rate. For reasons, the state of Alaska, by law, says you have to use the National Council rate. Other states, it's different. So then we'd be right back with the wrap-up system. To say, to give an example, if the Alaska Timber Insurance Exchange would have obtained a portion of the logging contractors as we collect premiums, as they produce claims and or lack of claims, we then in turn return the premiums. That is their incentive to keep their safety record down to hopefully nothing. So it's, we're almost at a zero profit insurance company, which is amazing. It's not by tradition. You're not answering the review of the amendment. Not like the original one. I like the private sector portion of it.
And that's what happened. If I were your insurance, my pension, 5 years down.